Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Imagine yourself in this situation. You were in a terrible accident. You were incapacitated to the point where you cannot respond to your family or, more importantly, to the medical people that are trying to treat you. Could also be maybe a swift, debilitating illness. The details of the scenario, well, we'll leave that up to you. The important question is this. If something like that happened to you, how would you communicate to family, to medical personnel, how you would want to be treated? Now, I think that there are a lot of people who have at least thought about what they would like to have done or not done in a situation like that. But very few have actually talked about that with their family, with their doctor, have gone to the point of actually doing some thinking and planning about this issue. And that's what we're talking about here this morning. That is the importance of making your wishes known and doing that in a very sort of a concrete way. And our guest for the program is Dr. Diane Meyer. She is a physician. She's one of the leading figures in the field of palliative medicine. She's director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care, which is a national organization that's devoted to increasing the number and quality of palliative care programs in the U.S. She is also director of the Lillian and Benjamin Hertzberg Palliative Care Institute and professor of geriatrics and internal medicine and professor of medical ethics at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City, where she's been on the faculty since 1983. She's received a number of awards for her work, including a MacArthur Fellowship in 2008. She's published in all of the major peer-reviewed medical journals and has been extensively interviewed many times on television and in print. She's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. We do ask people to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving, get in as many calls as possible. And we certainly hope people will keep their comments focused on the subject that we're discussing here this morning. But that certainly leaves a lot of room for people to join in the conversation, and we welcome that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, by the way, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good to anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions certainly are welcome. Dr. Meyer, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. Let me ask you this question, because I know that you've had these conversations with your own patients, so I'm sure that you've spent time talking with people about it. But I think that while people would say, yes, I have thought about this, I wonder just to what depth they have thought about it. And in fact, if we just went out, you and I went out on the street, we started to stop people, and if we could engage them into this conversation, we could say, okay, imagine that you're in this situation. How much have you thought about what you would like to have happen? Do people really, to the kind of depth and in the detail that they should, actually think about these issues?
Well, more people than you might guess from reading the newspaper actually have not only thought about it, but spoken about it and actually completed documents deciding who they would trust to make medical decisions on their behalf if they were no longer able to. That's called, in some states, a durable power of attorney for health care. In other states, it's called a health care proxy or a health care agent. And all that means is, for example, if I were to be hit by a truck, as you mentioned in your introduction, tomorrow and be deeply comatose and obviously unable to communicate with my physicians, that I have appointed someone I trust, in my case I appointed my husband, to stand in for me, to make medical decisions along with my doctors. And he knows my wishes, so he knows that if there's any chance of recovery, I want absolutely everything done to give me every chance of returning to my life. But he also knows that if there's no chance of recovery and I'm basically in a vegetative state permanently and will never wake up to be able to interact with him or our children or other loved ones, that at that point I do not want treatment to prolong my vegetative existence. We've had that conversation with each other, and we have appointed each other as our trusted decision maker if we can't make our own decisions. And a lot of people have actually done that. In a study that one of my colleagues and I did a few years ago, was over 30% of people in senior centers in New York City, and that was 6 years ago. So a surprisingly large number have thought about it. And you almost can't help it. Anyone who has lived long enough has known people who have been very sick, either in their own family or neighbors or friends or even themselves, and has experienced some of what goes on in American hospitals, the lack of communication, the fragmentation, the care from multiple specialists. And people are afraid. And so increasing numbers are actually looking to get some control back in their lives. And then I would say there are always going to be a number of people who really just don't want to go there. Thinking about future illness or future disability or future dying is so frightening and so depressing for many people that they just don't even want to think about it and are trusting to God or trusting to their family or trusting to their doctors to make whatever decisions are necessary when the time comes. And I think that's very normal and natural. Serious illness and disability is not something anybody wants, not something anyone looks forward to. But there are ways to have that conversation with patients in a comfortable and reassuring way so that it's not frightening and so that people feel safe and well cared for.
Yeah. I have also seen this in some of the reading that I've done, seen this figure that something like a third of Americans have completed any form of advanced directive. So I guess that could be living will, durable power of attorney. Even if that number is a little bit bigger, say, you know, we'll bump it up 10%, say it's even 40%, that still would leave 60% that haven't done that. Now, I don't suppose that doesn't necessarily mean they haven't had that conversation, but what it means is that there's no legal document that can be pointed to indicate their wishes.
Well, that is true, but I want to hasten to point out that in most jurisdictions, most states in the United States, if a patient or a person has had a conversation, say, for example, while watching the news about Terri Schiavo a few years ago, many families talked about that. Many people said to their loved ones, don't ever do that to me if I'm in that state. Don't do that to me. That would be considered what is called clear and convincing evidence in most jurisdictions of a patient's wishes, that even if there isn't a piece of paper signed and witnessed, a clear verbal statement that was witnessed or heard by one or two other people would be considered adequate evidence of a patient's wishes in most jurisdictions. But while the line of your questioning is suggesting that the general public has failed to really address these issues in the numbers that we might hope that they do, I actually would place the responsibility squarely on the shoulders of doctors. And I actually think that these conversations should be initiated by doctors and should be initiated by doctors as a routine matter when they first establish a relationship with an adult patient. And I think the failure in the United States primarily has been that physicians neither take the time, have the training, nor are they particularly comfortable with initiating these conversations. And I think if physicians stepped up to the plate, we would see much both greater level of comfort in the American public with the issue, as well as a much higher level of participation in advanced care planning.
Well, you anticipated what was going to be my next question, and that was if physicians are not having this conversation with their patients, what are the reasons? And I wonder particularly there how you would rank those things. Two things stand out as particular issues to me. One, given that people, maybe they're one of their chief complaints about the way medicine is delivered these days is that they don't get to spend enough time with their doctors. So the question would be, well, how much is it a matter of time and how much is it that the physician perhaps feels uncomfortable in bringing the subject up and so he or she doesn't?
Well, the answer to that question, obviously, is it's both. First of all, when you go to medical school and do an internship and a residency, and perhaps you get specialty training in cardiology or oncology or surgery, you get almost no teaching about how to have a conversation with a patient about their wishes for care in the case of serious, irreversible illness or disability. So doctors can be forgiven for not being comfortable having these conversations since they were never taught how to do them. What's interesting about that is there are now lots of studies that show that doctors can be taught how to do it and that that teaching sustains itself, that even years later, physicians who had that teaching are quite a bit more comfortable and proficient talking with their patients about the future. But the fact remains, in most American medical schools, this content is either not taught or is so poorly taught that young physicians come out of training with no skills. That's the first issue. The second issue is, as you point out, there's no time. In one study, the major cause of dissatisfaction with medical care in the United States and with hospital care in particular was lack of enough time talking to doctors. 80% complained that they didn't have enough time with their doctors. And there's a certain irony to this, because if you're in the hospital, you know that doctors are swarming all over the place. When you get the bill, you see that you've been cared for by 8 or 10 different specialists, and yet none of them are sitting down to talk to you. Well, what's the reason for that? The reason is that doctors are compensated, paid by Medicare and other insurers, based on things that we do to you. So we are very well compensated, for example, for doing a procedure like a surgical procedure, or looking in your stomach with an endoscope, or giving you an intravenous infusion of a drug, such as a chemotherapy agent. But time spent sitting and talking with you is so poorly reimbursed, and these are so-called cognitive services. Cognitive services are so undervalued and underpaid that physicians literally cannot afford to spend any length of time talking with patients and families about what's going on. And those that do are sacrificing a great deal of income. So when you think about sitting down with a patient and exploring their hopes, their fears, their past experiences with family members who have been sick, what they've been thinking about, this is not a 5-minute conversation. This is a 30-minute conversation if it's done properly and if the doctor is really taking the time to listen carefully to his patient and his patient's family. And, you know, the fact is doctors just don't have time. You know, if you've ever been in a doctor's waiting room recently, it's pretty unusual to get in and not have to wait for more than an hour, and it's pretty unusual to be in a waiting room that's not stacked to the rafters with people waiting. And so these very profound, important components of the doctor-patient relationship, who is my patient, what is on their mind, what things matter most to them, how would they want me to handle it if they couldn't communicate with me, they don't happen.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Diane Meyer. She's director of the Hertzberg Palliative Care Institute, professor of geriatrics and internal medicine, and professor of medical ethics at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. She's been on faculty there since 1983. She's one of the leading figures in the field of palliative medicine here in the United States. We're talking about the importance of advanced care planning, that is, for people making their wishes known, to say, this, if I'm in a situation, an extreme situation and requiring medical treatment, and I cannot tell you what I want, I want you to know what I want. Going on record, talking about that with family, talking about that with their doctor. And so we are talking here about why it is that's important. And if people have any kind of questions about that, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and a toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that, again, if we went and tried to just to talk with people about what they would think about this, we would get people telling us things like, look, my feeling is if I'm here at this point where I'm very, very sick, and the doctors would have to say, well, we really can't make you better. I mean, that's what they would say to my family members, because I wouldn't be hearing that. We say, we cannot make you better. And I would say, all right, if you're at that point, you cannot make me better. There is no point in keeping me going. And I certainly don't want you to hook me up to a bunch of machines to keep me going. So I think people could tell you about that much. I wonder, though, how in, if again, if you were having this conversation with somebody, in how much detail would you have to go with that person and say to them, okay, I hear what you're saying now, but what I wanted to do is ask you some specific questions. Would you want, if you were in the situation, would you want me to do this procedure? Would you want me to do this? Would you want to do this? In other words, you know, and how much detail do you have to go into in talking with that person and getting them to say what it is that they want?
Well, that's a really good question and a source of tremendous misunderstanding. Actually, finding out that level of detail from patients is absolutely pointless because we cannot anticipate the future. So, for example, I've had patients come into my office. I see patients as a primary care doctor, you know, brandishing their living will and their advanced directive and saying, don't ever put me on a breathing machine. I never want that. I saw my mother die that way. Don't ever do that to me. And then I say, whoa, wait a minute, Mr. Jones, what if you happen to develop pneumonia? And your pneumonia was completely treatable, completely reversible. And yet, to get you through the pneumonia, you might need to be on a breathing machine for a few days or a week. Would you want a ventilator under that circumstance? And Mr. Jones says, of course I would. So the point is, and then we have to amend his living will to say, I don't want a ventilator only if there's no chance of recovery and no chance of my coming off the ventilator. But so you see that there are circumstances where even the most certain person would change their mind and say, oh, well, yeah, actually under that circumstance, yes, I would want a ventilator. Or say, for example, someone says to me, I never want a feeding tube. I never want to, you know, be fed artificially in that way. And then I'd say, wait a minute. You know, what happens if you have some kind of surgery that you're going to recover from, but while you're in the recovery period, you're unable to swallow? Would it be okay with you if we fed you through a tube while you were recovering from the surgery? And the patient says, of course, that would be okay. And yet their living will says no feeding tube. So that's why I counsel my patients not to talk at all about specific treatments, but rather to talk about under what circumstance, what clinical or medical circumstance they would not want their life prolonged. And this is how I address that question with my patients.
So it seems it is important that the person that you designate to make those decisions, and in my case it's my wife, and then after that it's my sister. So I've done that. Mm-hmm. And I know I should have discussed this before now with my doctor, which I haven't done, that what you're relying on, though, is that those people, they're going to look at your total picture. They're going to look at what's going on. They're going to look at the prognosis. They're mm-hmm. going to look and try to consider all of those things. And then, as best as they can, see that you're wishes are carried out. It seems that there is a fundamental issue of trust here. You're going to have to trust that those people who are making the decisions are going to make the decision that you would want them to make.
Yes, and all of human existence is predicated on trust and relationships. We are not purely autonomous creatures. But I think the point is, yes, you need to be able to trust your doctor, so I would suggest you choose your doctor well so that it's someone that you can really talk to and connect to and trust and talk about these issues and see how they react. And obviously you're going to appoint someone you trust to represent you in terms of medical decision-making. But the kind of question I think patients ought to think about is the following. It is, and this is how I put it, I say, let's imagine a situation just as you introduced this conversation earlier, where you were crossing the street and a truck turned the corner quickly and you were hit and you bled into your brain and they were unable to stop the bleeding in time and your brain got squeezed by all the blood pouring into your skull, which is a closed space, so there's no place for it to go, and you've been in an intensive care unit on a ventilator, you've had several neurosurgeries, it's 3 months later. And it's looking like you're not going to recover. If you were in that situation, and it's looking like for the rest of your life you will be essentially vegetative like Terry Schiavo, you may be able to come off the ventilator, but you will not get out of bed, you will not return to your family, you will always be in an institution. So let's imagine that situation. And then I say, some of my patients say that if they were in that situation, they would want me to do everything possible to prolong their life for as long as possible, no matter what their brain function was like, whether it was a vegetative state or not. For them, they believe in miracles. They want everything done no matter what. And then others of my patients say that if they were in that state, not expected to recover to get any consciousness back, any ability to recognize or interact with their loved ones, they say that at that point they would want care strictly focused on their comfort and not to prolong their life in a vegetative state. Which kind of person are you? And that, putting it that way, basically identifies the situation that for most people is a fate worse than death. About 90% of my patients in that, when presented with that scenario, say, if I were in that state, a Terry Schiavo-like state, I definitely do not want treatment to prolong my life. But 10%, 1 out of 10 of my patients say, I believe in miracles, I'm terrified of death, I want you to do everything no matter what. And what I do at that point is I document exactly what they say in the medical record. And then not only I, but every other physician that's caring for that patient has access to that information. And it's tremendously helpful, primarily to the family decision makers who are torn with guilt and stress when presented with this type of decision making, when they don't know what their loved one would have said if they were able to comment. And so the main reason I think that patients do this and are willing to think about things that are so unpleasant and difficult to think about is in an effort to protect their families, their children, their spouses, from having to make extremely difficult decisions, as it were, in the dark, without any evidence of what you, the patient, would want. It is dramatically easier for families if they are honoring you, honoring your wishes, honoring who you are as a person, when they are confronted, as they inevitably will be for each one of us, with a difficult set of decisions.
And I have some callers here. I promise I get right to them. It just seems to me here, this is an important point, given all the controversy that is surrounding the subject right at the moment, that what you are saying is that you want to make sure that people understand that you as a physician and anybody's physician is not going to say, this is what I think you should do. What the physician is saying to the patient is, you tell me what it is you want us to do, and then that is what we will do, whichever way you want to go. It's, you know, if you want everything that can be done to be done, you say that. I'm going to write it down here. That's what we're going to do. But if you don't, you tell me, I'll write it down here. That's what we're going to do. I think the important thing is what you're saying to people is they should say what they want, say it clearly, get it down there so everybody knows. And then if it gets to that point, not only will then their wishes be followed, then that really makes it a whole lot easier on everybody else because they can say, this is what he said he wanted.
Right.
So that's what we're going to do.
Right. So, for example, I have had patients who are very clear that they wanted, quote, everything done, no matter how poor the prognosis, no matter how poor their quality of life would be. And while their family members might not want that for themselves, or their doctors might think, this is ridiculous, this person is suffering terribly, why are we doing all this? As soon as it becomes clear that that's what the patient chose, the conflict goes away. And it dramatically facilitates achievement of what the patient wants if the patient says so in advance.
We're at a midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Diane Meyer. She's director of the Hertzberg Palliative Care Institute at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, where she is also professor of medical ethics and a professor of geriatrics and internal medicine. And we're talking here about the importance of advanced care planning, making your wishes known, what it is you would want to be done if you were in a position of not being able to speak for yourself. We have a couple of callers. The numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go to Philo and line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes.
I'm a critical care medicine practitioner, and let me just assure you, you're preaching to the choir here. But I'd be interested in your comments on a few things. First of all, I have been shocked by the relative lack of outrage regarding the statements made by Sarah Palin recently in regard to the death panels. I don't know whether too many people are concerned that that's a third rail they don't want to touch, and that explains their silence, but it just has amazed me that the people of your ilk and organizations that wish to foster the goals that you seek to be fostered regarding end-of-life care have not really taken her to task for her statement. So I'd be interested in your comments on that, or perhaps you don't perceive that they've been as silent as I do.
Yeah, I actually agree with you that there's been a great deal of, I would say, reasoned and calm and perhaps too cerebral response to this on the part of the medical profession, the various organizations, certain, for example, there was a press conference last week sponsored by Health Affairs that was carried on C-SPAN and got a lot of other press attention. What we haven't been able to do, though, in a sense, is fight fire with fire. The language that Sarah Palin and others like her have used is highly inflammatory, emotional, frightening, and it basically prevents rational dialogue. And I think those of us trying to respond tend to prefer rational dialogue, and therefore we have not been fighting fire with fire. And I'm not sure I even know how, you know, to go on the attack like that, to make things up that aren't true, to attempt to terrify the public in the way that she and Betsy McCaughey and others felt very comfortable doing. It seems pretty clear to me that their agenda was political and not substantive. And I guess I'm a believer in trying to respond with reasoned, rational, calm communication with the public, which is why I'm doing this now and have been doing this type of thing pretty much nonstop for the past 3 weeks.
The second comment I'd like to make and hear your comments on is the hierarchical value of durable power of attorney and living wills. In my experience and practice, I have actually found living wills often limiting. As you're very familiar with, they often give you three different scenarios and ask you to initial which one reflects your values. And when those are filled out in a vacuum, as they often are, ignorance leads to things being checked that as you've alluded to, a little exploration will find that that's not what the patient would wish at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, how many patients don't recognize the very narrow definition that is a vegetative state as opposed to a neurologically devastating condition? And I often tell patients and their families that the neurologically devastated non-vegetative state perhaps carries, or not perhaps, I think definitely usually carries greater capacity for suffering than the vegetative state.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they may have checked the box that says, do everything unless I'm in a vegetative state.
Right.
So I will often, and perhaps this is too strong a statement, tell family that sometimes I'm not sure living wills are worth the paper they're printed on, that a far more valuable document is the healthcare power of attorney, hopefully established with discussion of values and things like that, that allows us to deal with circumstances that could not possibly all be addressed by a living will. And yet I see so many people coming in with a living will feeling they're covered. And a lot of this has to do, I think, with people believing that a durable power of attorney is something that they have to go to an attorney to get, as opposed to, you know, at least in our state of Illinois, two witnesses and you're good to go on a durable power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I haven't seen the durable power of attorney getting quite the press that the living will does.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do to perhaps increase the numbers of durable powers of attorneys, not necessarily at the expense of living wills, because they can be complementary, of course, but I see big problems with that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I tried to explain before why a living will, which says I do want this, I don't want that, doesn't really help, because we cannot anticipate what you might need in the future. And that there are two things that I think every patient and family member, along with their physician, needs to do. One is to appoint someone that you trust to make medical decisions on your behalf if you're unable to make your own. And in Illinois, I guess that's a durable power of attorney for health care. In New York State, that's a health care proxy. And the second thing is to articulate what you would want if your brain was so damaged, and I don't use the term vegetative state, permanently damaged so that you would no longer be able to recognize and interact with loved ones. I don't use a neurologic term, rather a functional term, that you would no longer be able to recognize and interact with loved ones, and that every physician believes that state to be permanent. That under that circumstance, would you want treatment focused on prolonging your life, or would you prefer treatment focused on your comfort in that state? And it doesn't use terminology that is too limiting. So I strongly recommend those two steps: to articulate wishes under that circumstance and to appoint someone. And as I said before, and you're a physician, so you know where the barriers are, I think a big part of the reason that many people have not appointed a decision maker is because their doctor has never discussed it with them. And that we really need to focus on medical education, residency education.
If I might make a final comment in direct response to that last statement, there's no question that physicians have dropped the ball in this area, but I don't think I'm being too pessimistic when I say I'm not sure we'll ever pick it up again. as you said, I have heard physicians say straight out, they don't discuss it because they're uncomfortable with the topic.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know how you get around it. Then there's just the ignorance of things such as CPR outcomes in hospitalized patients, morbidity or mortality associated with multi-organ system failure, something I deal with in the intensive care unit.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times I've been told by oncologists how well somebody's cancer is doing while they have septic shock and multi-organ system failure as a consequence of the infection due to their chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to make light of it, but I tell family that he would be lucky enough to live long enough to die from his cancer, because right now he has a much more serious issue. And there are many physicians who do not understand that, A, poor outcomes from CPR in different categories of patients. And also, as I said, the prognostic significance of things like multi-organ system failure, which people who don't deal with it every day don't appreciate. But, the old joke, the surgery was a success, but the patient died.
Mm-hmm.
I deal with this every single day. And if we cannot educate physicians, I don't know how we'll ever educate the public.
But that's my point. We can't hold patients and families responsible when the people they go to and that they trust for medical guidance can't bring themselves to address these issues. So I think we have to look to our own house.
Exactly, but as I said, maybe I'm too much of a pessimist, but I also think there are other people who are better informed than many physicians who could educate, and yet people have felt that this is somehow the exclusive realm of physicians, and as I said, the reality is such that if we hold that view, things aren't going to happen, I just don't know where else we can turn for that education, or to refer people to, or to just, as I said, pick up the ball that the physicians have dropped and run with it.
There are moments when I share your pessimism, but most of the time I'm more optimistic that given the right tools and the right support and the right mentoring, physicians really do want to do the right thing by their patients. If they were compensated for having conversations with patients, perhaps they would have them more often. If they were really well-trained in having these conversations, perhaps they would have them more often. If patients and families were better educated and came to physicians asking to have these conversations, we need all of these things to happen.
But unfortunately, compensation is directly what the portion of the health care bill that has been labeled the death panel was looking to address, and it was just backed away from so quickly. As I said, I was shocked. But I would agree with you. If the compensation and recognition of the value of the time spent in these discussions was recognized, but as I said, with the most recent goings on, I just sort of see that compensation now not happening. But
well,
thank you very much for your comments.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, thank you. Thanks for your comments. It's lovely to talk to you. I guess I would say I think this latest debacle around death panels, which, by the way, for everyone listening, is pure lies, is something of a tempest in a teapot, and that actually the big picture is that there's been a lot more conversation about these issues as a result of these lies, and that in the end that will be a positive thing.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Diane Meyer. She's director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care. This is a national organization devoted to increasing the number and quality of palliative care programs in the U.S. She's also a director of the Hertzberg Palliative Care Institute. That's at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City, where she's also professor of geriatrics and internal medicine and professor of medical ethics. She is one of the leading figures in the country in the field of palliative medicine. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. I wonder, I hope you wouldn't mind if I ask you a slightly different question, but one that connects to your work in the field of palliative care. And that is, it seems to me that, again, when people talk about, you know, what their concerns are about being gravely ill, that people seem to talk a lot about pain. They're very worried about pain. And sometimes I think they're more worried about feeling pain than they are worried about dying. And I'm sure people like you would say, well, people don't need to be worried about that because we know a lot about controlling pain. I mean, it's not a technical issue. It's not that we don't know how to do it. But it seems that at the same time, the level of pain control that's out there is not up to the technology to do it. And so that prompts the question, well, really, what's going on? What's the problem?
Oh, my.
I realize
we're talking about very contentious issues here. It's a medical education problem, just as the doctor-patient communication deficit is a medical education problem. Most physicians, and I know this is shocking to the public, but it's true, have received either no or totally inadequate training in the management of pain. It is frightening in a way to know how poorly prepared your average physician is to deal with the most common medical problem that brings people to the doctor, which is pain. We're working very hard to correct that in recent years to make sure that undergraduate medical education, that is the medical students and residency and internship training, postgraduate medical education, start to include substantive palliative care content, among which is the, you know, pain, what I call pain 101, the assessment and safe and effective treatment of pain. But I would say we have a long way to go. So it's very important for patients and families to advocate for themselves if they're having pain. If your physician minimizes it or trivializes the impact of your pain or fails to treat it in a way that relieves your pain, you need to ask for a referral to a palliative medicine specialist or to a pain specialist, because pain, as we like to say, pain kills. Pain is really bad for your health. It causes immunosuppression. It increases your risk of depression and other illnesses. It causes people to, you know, stay home and become deconditioned and far less functional. And treatment of pain dramatically improves health and functioning and well-being. And when handled by physicians who know what they're doing, is quite safe, pain management. So we have a lot of both public and professional education to do so that people understand that, for example, opioids, morphine and morphine-type derivatives, when used correctly for people with medical illness, are actually quite a bit safer than Tylenol, or Motrin or Advil, because those drugs, particularly in the elderly, can cause very serious organ failure. Tylenol can cause liver failure. Motrin and Advil can cause kidney failure and bleeding, which particularly in my Medicare age patients can become quite life-threatening, and yet they're over-the-counter, so people assume they're safe. Mm-hmm. Morphine and its derivatives, things like Vicodin or Percocet, when properly dosed and when patients are well-educated about how to use them and how to handle their side effects, are actually quite a bit safer. Mm. And so because of the just say no drug culture in the United States, because of substance abuse, and addiction, there's a public and professional fear of this class of medicines, which far outweighs their risk. And the result is that many people live often for many, many years with severe untreated pain that is unnecessary.
And some of that is coming from physicians who have concerns about using these
medicines?
Because
that's how they were trained. I went to Northwestern University Medical School. I did my internship and residency in Portland, Oregon, and my fellowship in Portland, Oregon, and I was taught, that if a patient told me they were in pain, that I should immediately assume that they were a manipulative drug-seeking patient. That's the teaching. That a patient in pain asking for relief, the first assumption is that they're dishonest and they're a manipulative, drug-seeking, substance abuser. That's the medical education that's going on.
I'm just staggered. Just staggered by that.
It is frightening and shocking to the public to hear that, because we assume that if we're going to have difficult pain, that our doctors are going to help us. We don't have a medical profession or a nursing profession trained the way we should be about helping our fellow humans with these kinds of problems. And that is another major medical education challenge ahead of us in the United States. I have many patients with serious illnesses. Some have cancer, some have end-stage kidney disease or liver disease or emphysema or heart failure, and their greatest fear is that they'll have pain that won't be managed, and particularly towards the end of their lives. The greatest fear of my patients is not death. It's untreated pain. And I can reassure them, because I am their doctor and I know how to manage pain safely and effectively. But I can understand why they're afraid, and I think they're afraid because they've seen other people in their own family or neighbors or friends whose pain wasn't treated. So their fear is based on real experience, and unfortunately, I'm sorry to say that fear is often justified.
Yeah, it's surprising that in an individual like that, at that point, mm-hmm. that physicians would be bothering to concern themselves about issues like dependency or, you know, potential side effects. Mm-hmm. When you have a patient like that, mm-hmm. you'd might think, well, gee, isn't that kind of trivial to be worrying about that at this point?
It's, again, because physicians are human, and the same kind of emotional overreaction attached to this class of drugs that the public has been affected by also affects doctors. Mm-hmm. And that mythology and overreaction has to be countered by very effective, powerful medical education, and it hasn't been.
Right. We have a couple of callers. Well, we have one caller here. We'll get in certainly before we run out of time. In Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yes. Here's my question. I have been going through a series of issues with my structural issues, bone, back, et cetera, and have been in pain actually for years. But I am also, I try to be physically active, work out, et cetera. My question is, do you have any ideas of how to talk to your doctor about that? Because I have spoken with them several times about my pain, and I have recognized that one of the pain medications, Vicodin, is really helpful for me and lets me feel like I can get up and clean the house and I can do the things that I would normally do at the age of 45 instead of feeling like I need to sit around. But I find that every time I talk to them, there is an implicit thing in the room that makes me feel as if I have to try and justify asking for that medication, and then I end up not asking for it because I don't want to be thought of as a possible junkie, mm-hmm. and then I go away in pain again.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, again, you're going to have to do some doctor searching. There are some physicians who are very well trained in the appropriate management of chronic pain. So, for example, I have a patient with spinal stenosis right now who I've been taking care of for over 20 years. And this person actually takes OxyContin twice a day. With the OxyContin, he is still driving to work every day. He works full-time, takes care of his yard, is handy around the house. Without the OxyContin, he was bedbound from back pain. He's been on the same dose of OxyContin for over a decade. He's never had to increase that dose. It has no effect on his cognitive status. He's alert. He's a practicing attorney, requires lots of, you know, brain power. Without the medicine, he literally couldn't leave the house. He was crawling. He was unable to walk from back pain. So it's important for physicians to understand that when these drugs are used properly and managed by a physician and a patient who are fully informed and well-educated, they are not only safe, they give people back their life, just as you're describing. If you are seeing physicians who are not comfortable with the use of opioids for the management of chronic pain, I suggest you try to identify a palliative medicine expert in your community who are more often caring for people with serious life-threatening illness and pain, like cancer and pain, or heart failure and pain. But sometimes palliative medicine practitioners will also take care of patients with chronic pain from non-life-threatening illnesses.
Okay.
And that is a group of physicians who are much better trained and much more expert in the safe and appropriate use of opioids for chronic pain. Failing that, I would actually find yourself a pain specialist. And those are usually anesthesiologists, and you can look that up. Either go to the university medical center nearest to you.
Okay.
And ask for that. But basically, you're seeing doctors who haven't been trained in the management of chronic pain.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Let's get one more caller here. This is Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I want to go back to what you were talking about first a little bit before, and I just want to make a comment about the end of life issues and the healthcare bill, and that has brought up a broader issue, about people after a certain age not being able to get dialysis and that sort of thing, and that is the general assumption in society now that somehow a child's life is always more important than an older person's life. And I just don't like that assumption. I don't like people to always say, we'll get rid of the old people and save the young people. And that's not just in the bill. I see that everywhere. But I'll give you one example, and then I'll shut up and let you talk about it. Let's say you have a colony of 100 people on an island, and two of them have been bitten by a snake, and there is only antidote enough to save one of the people. Now, one of them is a 3-year-old normal child, and the other is an 80-year-old. But he is the only doctor on the island, and he in turn can save the other 98 if they get sick. Now, who are you going to give the antidote to? Now, the reason I'm saying that is because a lot of times these older people, yeah, they're older, they might be sick or whatever, they have a lot of expertise, knowledge, et cetera, that they can pass on to the younger generation. I'll let you talk about that.
All right. And we're kind of short on time, but you can respond any way you like.
I do want to respond. Yes. I'm a geriatrician. Yes. So my primary care practice are all patients over 65, and the vast majority are over 85, and they're all going to outlive me. They're so healthy. I don't think anyone is talking about rationing based on age. I think, unfortunately, that's been a viral lie that has spread through the conscious dishonesty of certain people who are out to not only destroy the current administration, but destroy any chances of health reform. Our country provides better and more health care to older people than any other country on the planet, and I will fight to the death to keep it that way. That's why we're so fortunate to have Medicare in this country, and that's why every person in this country should have equivalently good medical care that older people have. No one in any of the health reform bills is talking about restricting access to care for old people. That is complete mythology.
We're coming down to the point where we essentially have to finish, and we've touched on a lot of things here, including the confusing conversation about health reform in this country. Anything else on that subject that you just might like to have the opportunity to say?
I just want to say that, as we mentioned earlier, or you mentioned earlier, everything about society and the practice of medicine and human existence is based on trust. Mm-hmm. It's based on human relationships and human connection. And every aspect of things that are important to us is based on relationships and trust. And it's very important that as a society we pull together so that the least of us are cared for, and those most in need and most vulnerable feel safe and secure in their society. And that's what medical care should be all about. It's not about taking something away from one person to give it to another person. It's about creating a safety net that will hold all of us in our time of need.
Our guest this morning in this hour, Dr. Diane Meyer. She is director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care. This is a national organization interested in increasing the number and the quality of palliative care programs in the country. She's also director of the Hertzberg Palliative Care Institute, professor of geriatrics and internal medicine, and professor of medical ethics at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. And Dr. Meyer, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.